The task of writing about early 20th century female social reformers is not an easy or a straightforward one. While it is necessary to celebrate their accomplishments, it is also necessary to be open-mindedly critical of the ideas they espoused and the causes they championed. In the case of Carrie Derrick, we are here to celebrate her most remarkable accomplishment, becoming the first female professor at a Canadian university. We are also here today to acknowledge her work in the Montreal Suffrage Association, her advocacy of the rights of working women and disadvantaged children, her efforts to protect the citizens of Montreal from communicable diseases, her dedication to increasing the number of female professors at Canadian universities, and her struggle for peace through the League of Nations Society, and there are many others. Yet when looking at the social reformers of Carrie Derrick's generation, we must take the good with the bad. As I have argued in the case of Rose Henderson, their generation was one at least until the outbreak of the First World War, and in many cases even after, that believed passionately in the improvement of the human race. We can only marvel at women who really believed that it was possible to create a world of perfect justice. And I've written about this in more detail about Rose Henderson. They really believed this. Really, really, really believed it. Okay? Given their commitment, it is no surprise that they reacted with a kind of moral indignation to anything that threatened their vision of the future. One of those threats was the people they called mental defectives, or the feeble-minded. I'm going to stop doing this from now on, okay? I'm just going to trust you to trust me that this is, the language of the period. It is necessary to overcome the kind of self-righteousness that characterizes progressive thinking in our own day in order to provide a dispassionate assessment of Carrie Derrick and the feminists of her generation. I have some concerns about the present political moment on what is broadly called the left. We spend a great deal of time reading history backwards. We spend a great deal of time judging historical figures by the morality of our own day. And I try to adhere to the belief that we should be reading what they read and understanding why they thought the way they did in the context of their own time. It's not something that I find terribly admirable, right, to being judging people morally who can't defend themselves. That they were advocates of eugenics, a term coined in 1883 by Francis Galton, the cousin of Charles Darwin, is beyond dispute. They did believe that the people they called mental defectives were a serious threat to the creation of a society free of war, poverty, and discrimination based on race, creed, and sex. We must remind ourselves that even members of the Famous Five, now immortalized on Parliament Hill, were among its advocates as well. Carrie Derrick was in good company, and as some of you know, that company includes Tommy Douglas. At the same time, questionable use of evidence, problematic lines of argument, and a penchant for sweeping generalizations has lumped together an entire generation and tarred them with the same brush. So let's take a look at what's warranted and what is not in the case of Carrie Derrick. We begin by confronting Carrie Derrick's worldview and all its distastefulness. As late as 1929, the year Derrick retired from her teaching position at McGill, she inhabited a world in which children with the mental capacity of two-year-olds were idiots, children with the mental capacity of 3 to 7 year olds were imbeciles, children with the mental capacity of 7 to 10 year olds were morons, and beyond this, was another group of children who were just dull. Derrick did believe that the major source of feeble-mindedness was immigrant families. In the pre-First World War paper on juvenile delinquency, Derrick noted with approval that the National Council of Women had recently called for stricter immigration laws as a means of keeping the feeble-minded out of the country. In addition, Derek's advocacy of compulsory schooling had a eugenics rationale. As late as 1929, at least, Derek believed that in the province of Quebec, it was likely that the majority of defective children did not attend school. She had been supporting compulsory schooling for several decades by this time, her rationale being that if parents had to send these children to school, they could be identified, segregated, supervised, and treated. Derek's call for the segregation of the feeble-minded is important because it alerts us to one of the misperceptions that has been advanced. Having acknowledged Derek's forthright advocacy of eugenics, we must at the same time be wary of inferences that have been drawn from it. In his 1998 article, Eugenics, McGill and the Catholic Church in Montreal and Quebec, 1890 to 1942, Sébastien Normandin links Derek to Helen McMurtry and her advocacy of eugenic sterilization. McMurtry, who got her medical degree from the University of Toronto in 1901, was Ontario's Special Inspector of the Feeble-Minded from 1906 to 1919, and from 1920 to 1934 was the Chief of the Child Welfare Division in the Federal Department of Health, right? And this tells you something that, you know, a Special Inspector of the Feeble-Minded tells you how widespread, right, this belief was at the time. In the First World War period, Carrie Derek accepted McMurtry's figures for the number of feeble-minded in the province of Ontario. Now, while I cannot state categorically that Derek never advocated sterilization, I can attest to the fact that in the number of documents written by Carrie Derek that I have seen, nowhere does she advocate sterilization. On the 12th of March 1915, Prime Minister Robert Borden received a delegation from the National Council of Women asking him to appoint a Royal Commission on Mental Deficiency, which did not happen. I'm not exactly sure why, although it is interesting that the only province that said no to this Royal Commission on Mental Deficiency was Saskatchewan. And I don't know why that is. Quebec agreed to it, and guess what the proviso was? As long as there was no interference with provincial areas of jurisdiction. The province of Quebec agreed to it. But it didn't happen. The appeal was written by Carrie Derek. In her submission, Derek advocates, quote, training and segregation, unquote, not sterilization. Like Helen McMurtry, Derek was an advocate of eugenics, but her answer was to keep male and female mental defectives segregated, not to sterilize them. We can argue later, okay? She doesn't want mental defectives reproducing. Okay, and you can argue with me that this basically amounts to the same thing, right? But I think it's an important distinction that she's not actually advocating sterilization. But as I say, you can disagree with me on that. Is there then any validity to Sébastien Normandin's claim that Derek's advocacy of eugenics was directed at French Canadian families? When she wrote about the linkage between feeble-mindedness and large families, Normandin says that her description, quote, sounds disturbingly like a typical French-Canadian family of the time, unquote. Normandin may be right, but it sounds like a typical Irish Catholic family of the time as well. Indeed, the evidence suggests that if any ethnic group was targeted by Derek's condemnation of the feeble-minded, it was the Irish. In May 1919, Derek wrote The Social Menace of Feeble-Mindedness as the convener of the Committee on Mental Deficiency. In her piece, Derek provides a number of examples of families affected by mental deficiency, with most examples featuring the Irish, Scots, and Jews. Again, as in her submission to Prime Minister Robert Borden in March 1915, Derek's solution is segregation, not sterilization. Given Sébastien Normandin's claim that Derek was targeting French Canadians, it is instructive that she gives no examples linking French Canadian families and feeble-mindedness. Okay? This is one of these sweeping generalizations that I think we need to be careful about. What is true, as Sebastian Ormandin points out, is that there is an irrational fear of immigrants and Derek's attribution of feeble-mindedness in families. This fear was not justified, given that Derek's own arguments claimed that almost 70% of mental defectives were Canadian-born. And this is where I'm critiquing Derek on the basis of the fact that she is contradicting her own evidence, right? Right? She knows that 70% of the feeble-minded are Canadian-born, but she's focusing on immigrants, okay? And I think that that is something that we can criticize her for. What is not warranted, however, is connecting Derek's position with being anti-French Canadian or racist. It is revealing that in one of the studies she cites, 31.25% of the feeble-minded, it's kind of like having 2.5 kids, were immigrants, and fully 96%, almost 100% of those immigrants were born in the British Isles. 96%, okay? I've seen this elsewhere. Anglo-Celts, they're not talking about Asians, blacks, they're talking about their own ethnic group, okay? There's a great book to be written about this. There is, of course, a bigoted component to her ideas because there is clearly mental deficiency is a danger that threatens Anglo-Celtic ascendancy in Canada. Okay, there is a bigoted, or if you will, racist component to the thinking here, but she is not targeting, right, non-Anglo-Celtic peoples. Her thinking is directed at peoples from the British Isles, not at French Canadians, Black Canadians, South Asian Canadians, or even Southern and East Europeans, with the possible exception of Jews. And I've found no evidence. I would not characterize Derek as anti-Semitic based on what I have seen. This is interesting because the leading advocate of eugenics and intelligence testing in the United States, a guy called Henry Goddard, tended to focus on Jews, Russians, Hungarians, and Italians. Derek does not appear to have picked that up, right? Which is interesting. We must also be aware of evidence that Kerry Derek's attitudes toward immigration changed over time, okay? This is another thing we do as historians. We pick people out of, you know, periods in history, and we say, okay, that characterizes their thinking, when in fact their thinking changed over time. And because I'm in Quebec, I mean, an excellent example is André Laurendeau, who was one of the co-chairs of the Bilingualism and Biculturalism Commission appointed by Pearson in the early 1960s. You can go back to the 1930s when André Laurendeau was involved with Jeune Canada and turn him into an anti-Semite. And Laurendeau later in life acknowledged, right, that he had been anti-Semitic as a young man, right? But I still have tremendous respect for André Laurendeau. And we can't just take these ideas that appear in one period and then extrapolate them across the entirety of a person's life. Okay? There was, as Diane Dodd points out, a shift in attitude after the First World War. Dodd writes, quote, in the heyday of immigration prior to the First World War, reformers located the source of eugenic contamination in the free flow of immigrants entering the country. By the interwar period, however, reformers were more willing to see the problem as internal, and some began to pin their hopes for racial improvement on the prevention of insanity and feeble-mindedness via healthy child-rearing practices, right? So this, the emphasis shifts, right, from, you know, sterilization, segregation, to preventing the problem in the first place. By the late 1920s, Kerry Derek is convener of a special subcommittee of the Protestant Committee of the Council of Education, had not abandoned her concern about feeble-minded immigrants, but her focus had shifted decisively to the mental testing of children in the Protestant school system. Okay? And this is another concern I have about Normandin, is that he dissociates French Canadians from involvement with eugenics, but Derek, in fact, identifies two medical doctors who I think were at Université de Montréal. One was Dr. Delage, and the other was, I think his name was Baudouin, who were doing this kind of research into eugenics and intelligence testing. Okay, So it's not just Kerry Derrick. Also instructive is a 1924 talk Derrick gave in Toronto to the 31st Annual Convention of the National Council of Women, in which she argued that it would be dangerous to make immigrants give up their home ties, customs, and traditions. It would be dangerous for them to give them up. Okay? While the evidence is fragmentary and does not warrant a sweeping generalization, it is convincing enough to expose the falsity of simply reading Derrick's attitudes toward immigrants as a whole off her advocacy of eugenics, right? Just making this kind of simple one-to-one equation between the two. Okay? In fact, if this one speech is any indication, we might better be identifying Kerry Derrick as an early advocate of multiculturalism. In his biography of Lenin, author Christopher Reed points out that the Bolshevik leader, quote, asked for special consideration to be afforded to defective adolescents, as he called them, or special needs teenagers, as we would call them today. Reed reminds us that the words we use may have changed more than the attitudes. We can be repelled by Kerry Derrick's language, or we can acknowledge the progressive element in her call for these children to be educated separately so they would no longer be, quote, humiliated and discouraged by a sense of unfitness, unquote. And perhaps I'm going out a bit on a limb here, but I don't see this argument as so different from the argument of feminists who argue that women should have separate teachers' unions, or that take back the night marches should be female only. Right? There is an element here, right, that women have to get away from being humiliated, right, by their association with men, right? And there can be an implication that there's a kind of unfitness in women, right, that makes them incapable of, you know, dealing with being in organizations with men, right? I don't think the two things are all that different. In some cases, we do not even need to change the language. We have no difficulty in accepting her advocacy of special classes funded by special government grants. If the bigotry of Kerry Derrick and her generation of feminists is a chasm that lies between us, it is a chasm linked by a sturdy bridge. Thank you.